everyone who loves books. This is Read on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, your weekly compendium of the best in books and reading. I'm your host Red Sail, and coming up in today's show, Cara Hunter takes us behind the veneer of genteel Oxford with D.I. Adam Forley.
I think it does keep people reading. I've had so many people say to me, I just keep saying to myself, one more page, and then it's 2 o'clock in the morning.
Mitch Cullen reveals what Sherlock Holmes is up to, aged 93.
Some mysteries and some kind of lost threads from the past that he's trying to deal with and revisit while he can.
Narrator David Thorpe tells us about Nightingales in November,
which is a year in the lives of 12 British birds by a guy called Mike Dilger, who is the natural history guy that you may have seen on BBC One's The One Show.
And I review the spy story that 007 author Anthony Horowitz selected as one of the books of his life. That's all coming up in today's Read On. Cara Hunter is a major new name in British crime writing. Her debut novel, Close to Home, received rave reviews and was a Richard and Judy Book Club pick in spring 2017. Its sequel, In the Dark, published a year later, was equally highly praised. Set in Oxford, the books follow D.I. Adam Forley and his major crimes investigation team.
Someone said, didn't they, that April is the cruelest month? Well, whoever it was, they weren't a detective. Cruelty can happen any time. I know, I've seen it. But the cold and the dark somehow dull the edge. Sunlight and birdsong and blue skies can be brutal in this job. Perhaps it's the contrast that does it. Death and hope. The story starts with hope, May the 1st, the first day of spring, real spring. And if you've ever been to Oxford, you'll know. It's all or nothing in this place.
Fast-paced and fiendishly plotted, the series has drawn comparisons with TV dramas such as Broadchurch and The Line of Duty. With a third novel out next spring, Cara Hunter took me behind the scenes to tell me more. Cara Hunter, welcome to Read On.
I'm very pleased to be here.
I believe Detective Inspector Adam Forley was born on a beach holiday.
He was born on a beach holiday. It's quite a funny story to it. I'm such a crime fiction fan, in fact, true crime as well, which we can probably come on to later. But I always used to take a huge stack of books on holiday with me. And my poor husband was lugging the case around. And I would sit next to him on the beach reading my books, and I would get to the end of it. And I'd sort of throw it down on the sand and say, oh, it was all right up till the end, but the ending wasn't very good. But after hearing this many times, the poor man eventually said to me, look, why don't you write one of these things? So there you are. That's where it all started.
So what do you think the essential ingredients of a great crime novel are?
Well, I think it's the twist, but I would say that, wouldn't I? Because that's the thing that I really concentrate on in my books. There was a lovely comment I heard from Sophie Hannah once where she said the great twists in crime fiction can be summarised in 4 words. And Agatha Christie, of course, is a great favourite of hers, and indeed of mine. She's the real mistress of the 4-word twist. So if you think about it, Murder on the Orient Express, they all did it, you know, 4 words. And The Murder of Roger Ackroyd, which is one of my favourites, the narrator did it. So you see, there's one big, really big, big idea, and then everything else springs from that. And Close to Home in particular started that way. The twist is, if you've read it, and if you do read it, you'll see what I mean, that it's really a 4-word twist, and everything started with that, and worked backwards from the twist to develop the story. So yes, I think the twist really is it, and I love doing that, and I love keeping people guessing.
It is a killer twist at the end of Close to Home. I very nearly dropped my phone, which I was listening to the audiobook on, and as I gasped, but we won't give it away. Your books are also really full of social realism. They are very much crimes that you can imagine hearing about on Crime Watch. Did you feel that that was something that you had to embrace as well?
Not had to, but wanted to. I think part of that, thinking about it now, stems from the fact they're set in Oxford. And of course, Oxford is one of the crime capitals of the world, and everybody knows it, which is a great advantage from my point of view. But it's got a very much the sort of Morse and Lewis and Endeavour feel about it in some ways. So one of the things I wanted to do quite specifically with the books was to show a different Oxford and, if you like, bring it more up to date. Because, I mean, I love all of those books and the TV, totally love them, but they are of their time in a way. So I wanted to do something that would feel very modern and would give an insight into other aspects of the city as well, because it is a fascinating place. I mean, it's not all about beautiful ivy-clad colleges and quads. So it was very much one of the things I wanted to explore, was how the different parts of the city all overlap and intermingle, and how the stories start to evolve from those overlaps, if you like.
I love the little sly references to Morse in both the books. They just make me laugh.
I don't do bloody crosswords, I know. Oh, and did you pick up Erica Sommer? The way her name is spelled is S-O-M-E-R. So it's an anagram of Morse.
I had no idea.
Well, you might not, I suppose, with the audio, but it might not have spelled out how it's spelt, if you see what I mean. But yes, that's the reason she's got that name. It's a little nod, and her initial is E as well, which is the same as Morse. So it's just my little sort of, you know, drop something in and some people pick it up. It doesn't matter if you don't, because it doesn't mean anything. It's just a little joke.
It's lovely to nod to that history of Oxford, and Oxford's such a historical city in so many ways, and Morse is part of that fabric.
Oh, certainly now you can't go anywhere without falling over people offering Morse tours, and Morse, this is the pub Morse was in episode whatever, and oh yes, you can't avoid it.
Why do you think Oxford is the perfect city for the perfect murder?
I think it's become so because of those TV things. I don't know whether if those had never happened, you would necessarily think of it. But I suppose it is. It has got this interesting idea of different communities, which you might think from the outside would never sort of intersect at all. But in fact, they do in quite interesting and unpredictable ways sometimes. Though I don't think that's particularly drawn out in the Dexter books. I think he tends to keep it much more college focused in general. Not all of them, but that's why I tend to try and keep away from the university at the moment, because it's there's enough being done with that, so it's more sort of off screen, as it were, rather than an actual presence.
Yes, you do delve into the mucky parts under the veneer, and especially with Close to Home, the couple at the centre of the mystery are trying to keep up appearances. And when the crime occurs, that veneer is torn away and you see what the reality is.
Yes, very much so. I mean, certainly in the last few years, one of the things that's become very popular is this idea of domestic noir. So looking at how families work behind closed doors, if you like, and how the facade that pretty much all of us put up to the outside world may be concealing something much darker behind it. So that was, again, one of the sort of driving impulses of the book, I suppose, to bring that idea in and to explore the family and gradually to give people more and more insight through the flashbacks about what was really going on in the family in the months leading up to what happens to Daisy. So, yes, that was great fun, because it means you can also hide little red herrings and clues in there that hopefully when the reader finally gets to the end, they suddenly go, oh yes, of course I saw it was there, but I just didn't realize at the time what it meant, which is always a great fun part for the writer.
And the reader is as much a detective as Adam Fawley and his team. We're chasing down the blind alleys with him. Yes, they are red herrings, but they are the kind of things that the police end up wasting days upon. And you also show how much social media has influenced the way police investigate crimes and the way the public see crimes and report on crimes.
Yes, absolutely. That was very much in my mind as I was doing it, particularly anything now that involves a child. You get a huge amount of media and social media interest, and people on social media are sometimes entirely ill-informed about what's going on, though that doesn't stop them having an opinion and expressing it. And sometimes they actually have insights that again, only in hindsight, you realise someone's picked up on something or whatever it might be. So So, yes, that was, again, another way to make the story feel very modern, but also that's the reality. I mean, anyone who's involved in social media will know that the police do use things like Twitter now to ask people to help. Have you seen this person? They've gone missing or whatever it might be. So, yes, it has changed the way that police investigations are run, and they have to be so much more aware of what's going on around them. I think they can't have these inquiries can't happen in a vacuum anymore.
Yes, there's no going home to put your feet up with the detectives investigating the crime. It is a constant investigation. And is that part of the reason you decided not to use chapters?
Partly. It was partly also inspired by Crime TV, which I'm, as I said, a huge fan of. And I think some of the best crime writing now is actually for television. Anyone who's a fan of something like Line of Duty, I think, will know what I mean. I'm a massive fan myself. But the way they work, the best ones, there's a huge sense of pace in them. Lots of short scenes, lots of intercut scenes from different perspectives. And that was a sort of the experience I was trying to recreate on the page. So it was a way of just keeping the pace up, keeping the reader interested, and the listener interested, and also to have lots and lots of cliffhangers as well. Someone's called me the queen of the cliffhanger, which is one of those nice compliments you want to write and put on the wall. But yes, that does make it easier, and it does. I think it does keep people reading. I've had so many people say to me, I just keep saying to myself, one more page, and then it's 2 o'clock in the morning. So that's nice. That's the sort of thing you want to hear.
Yes, there are an awful lot of chores that haven't been done around my house over the last couple of weeks.
It's the best compliment you can pay me.
You mentioned the effect of series like The Line of Duty and, I guess, Broadchurch as well. Mm-hmm. For me as a listener, I felt that the books were almost like an audio-described TV series. And
oh, that's fascinating, yeah.
At one point in the second novel, In the Dark, you go back to a BBC TV programme that has been made about some historical killings within Oxford, and you actually provide the audio description, which I thought was fascinating. It's a multimedia book in some ways.
Well, thank you. Yes, I mean, one of the things that sort of evolved, really, I didn't sit down and decide to do this, but it goes back to what you said earlier about making the reader or the listener into a detective themselves. And one of the ways that I've done that is by including all sorts of other documents and sources of information in the book, so that the reader has lots of different sources coming at them from different angles, just like the police, of course. And sometimes the reader has the jump on the police because they're getting the flashbacks as well, which of course the police aren't. But there's all sorts of different documents now, and as you say, there's a transcript of a TV programme in the second book. There's a fire scene report in the third book, which involved going down to my local fire station and spending the morning talking to them about how they investigate fires, which is fascinating. But yes, that was quite deliberate as a way of making the reader or the listener into a detective and giving them a real fighting chance of working out what's going on, perhaps even before the police do.
I failed both times, the books feel remarkably well researched. You say you've been down to the fire station. Do you have a policeman on the inside who you check the drafts next to?
That's another interesting story. When I first went to see my editor at Penguin, and we didn't know each other at all at that stage, one of the things she said to me was, gosh, you must have a really good close relationship with someone in the police to have got all of this procedure right. And at that stage, I hadn't at all. I hadn't spoken to anyone. I'd just done as much as I possibly could, online, and in a way that you can find out lots of these days that you couldn't have done even, say, 5 years ago. And at that point, she said, well, I think perhaps it might be a good idea to find yourself a tame police officer. And through a friend of a friend, cut a long story short, I do now have a real-life detective inspector who goes through the first draft with me. And I also ask him questions if I need to during the writing of the first draft, but I try not to impinge too much on his time, because obviously he's a busy man with an important job. But there is a point when I've done my first draft and I'm reasonably happy with it that I start to farm it out to what I call now my pro team. So that includes him, but I've also got a QC who looks at it from the point of view of the legal aspects and, you know, bringing a case to court, what would stick, what would not. And also, fascinatingly, I have a real life forensic scientist who actually does crime scene or has in the past done crime scene investigation. And he's both, you know, absolutely fascinating, totally terrifying to listen to, because some of the things he's done, you make your hair stand on end. But he's absolutely brilliant, because he really does know his stuff, and it brings it to life. And I think it comes over that way on the page, and when you hear it as well, that the research has been done. And obviously I can't claim it's 100% right in every respect, but I've done my best.
So you mentioned earlier the third novel. Can you give us a little bit of a sneak preview and tell us when we can expect it on the shelves?
It's called No Way Out. And actually, interestingly, that's another thing about the series now. Each of my books, it has a three-word title, and they're all monosyllables, and they all mean something, or mean at least two or three things. So like In the Dark, the second book, can mean in the dark, literally, but also in the dark in the sense of not knowing what's going on. So this is now the third one with the same sort of theme. So it's called No Way Out, and it begins with a serious house fire in North Oxford. And from then on, it's a focus on a family. It's a family house, and it'll be out in April.
Well, I'm very much looking forward to it. Because of our relationship with Penguin, I know it'll be coming to the RNIB library like the first two books. I mentioned a little earlier in the interview, you don't shy away from looking at some of the social care needs that lead to crime. You deal with Alzheimer's in the second novel and fetal alcohol syndrome in the first. Any chance you might deal with a blind character at one point in one of your future novels?
Well, no reason why not. Absolutely no reason why not. So, yes, it's something I'm interested in myself. I mean, I certainly don't have the sort of challenges many of your listeners do, but I've had sight problems of my own in the past. I've had really, really bad floaters in one eye, which actually started to cause me serious difficulties, and I had to have various sort of laser treatment for those. So I know what it's like to gradually find that you're having problems dealing with sight loss. So it's certainly something that I would be interested in exploring, and would do my research as diligently as possible to make sure that I did it properly.
And obviously you must feel very strongly that the books should be made as accessible to as wide an audience as possible who might not otherwise be able to read the books in print.
Oh, absolutely. I think the audio ones are wonderful. I think particularly the first one, because they did... It is like a radio play, the first one, because they brought in different voices for every single different character in the book. And I think it added up to 37 in the end. And I actually had a Hitchcock moment. I'm in there. I actually do one of the voices myself. So full marks to anyone who spots me. But that was wonderful, because it was quite a nice project for Penguin themselves, because a lot of the people who did the voices were actually staff. So they sort of threw it open to staff to, you know, would you like to come and just do one of the social media voices for Close to Home? But the two central narrators, Lee Ingleby and Emma Caniff, are absolutely amazing, and I'm so lucky to have both of them. And they're both carrying on and doing the second and third books.
How long do you think the series will run for?
I'm currently contracted to do five. I'm currently writing the fourth one, and I'd love it to carry on. Let's hope. You know, you can't be sure of anything in life, but it would be lovely to keep doing them.
And do you think it will be replacing Morse and Lewis on our TV screens in the near future?
Oh, well, I would love that, obviously. It's every writer's dream to think that something might appear on TV. We'll see. It's certainly possible. Nothing definite at the moment, but I would love it. Of course I would.
Who would you pick as Adam Fawley then?
I don't know. People keep asking me that. Actually, the funny thing was the person I think looks most like him in my own mind actually isn't an actor. It's Mark Carney, the Governor of the Bank of England. But I suspect he's got rather too much on his plate to have a new career at this stage.
You heard it here first. Cara Hunter, thank you so much for being a guest on RNIB Connect Radio.
My pleasure.
Oxford's News at Oxford News Online, 1518.
Canal Manor hashtag abduction update. Sources say police have found bloodstained garments. Anyone with info should contact at Thames Valley Police. Hashtag find Daisy.
Elspeth Morgan at Elspeth Morgan 959, 1522. That poor family. I can't imagine what they're going through. Hashtag find Daisy.
BBC Midlands at BBC Midlands Breaking, 1545. Hashtag Midlands Today at 6 will have the latest on the disappearance of hashtag Daisy Mason. At Thames Valley Police earlier released a photo of her.
William Kidd at That Billy the Kid, 1546. If you know where Daisy Mason is, please call the police. Hashtag find Daisy. Hashtag Daisy Mason.
Anne Merivale at Annie underscore Merivale underscore, 1556. Am I the only one who thinks there's something odd about this hashtag Daisy Mason thing? How can a child disappear from her own garden and nobody see?
Caroline Tollis at For Whom the Tollis, 1605. At Annie underscore Merivale underscore. I agree, I said to my OH the moment we heard. There's more to that than meets the eye. Hashtag Daisy Mason.
Danny Chadwick at Chadwick Daniel PJ, 1607. What parents let their kids stay up to gone midnight? The obs weren't keeping proper tabs on her, only got themselves to blame. Hashtag Daisy Mason.
Angus Caudry at Angus N. Caudry Esquire, 1609. At Annie underscore Merivale underscore, at For Whom the Tollis, at Chadwick Daniel PJ. You mark my words, it'll be one of the parents. Always is. Hashtag Daisy Mason.
Close to Home, written by my guest today, Cara Hunter. Under a special agreement between RNIB and Penguin Random House, both Close to Home and In the Dark will soon be available in a full range of accessible formats from the RNIB library. You're listening to Read On, RNIB Connect Radio's one-stop shop for book news, reviews and author interviews. Still to come in this week's show, I discover a fictional cure for blindness in a gripping spy story, and narrator David Thorpe tells us about nightingales in November. But first, A Slight Trick of the Mind is a novel by Mitch Cullen, featuring a 93-year-old Sherlock Holmes. It was made into a film with Ian McKellen in the role of Holmes. Robert donned his deerstalker to investigate further.
His name is Mr. Sherlock Holmes.
Was that him? Have you ever been bitten?
Stung. Leaves don't have teeth.
You ever been bit?
No, I have never been bit.
Mr. Holmes, are you all right?
All right, Roger.
The photograph is her, isn't it? The woman in the story. Is it real?
The case was my last.
We're about to start an investigation.
Based on the novel A Slight Trick of the Mind by Mitch Cullen, who joined me in the Talking Book Studios to tell me about the book.
Slight Trick of the Mind is a novel, a literary novel, I should say. It's not necessarily a genre piece about Sherlock Holmes as an elderly gentleman living at his farmhouse in Sussex, having a very solitary life. He's 93 and he's tending his bees and working on some books that he's doing. And his memory is beginning to fade on him, as it does to some people as they get older. Which also brings into the mix some mysteries and some kind of lost threads from the past that he's trying to deal with and revisit while he can.
How much of the Conan Doyle source material did you read to get your Sherlock Holmes?
A lot, actually. It was important in order to write this version of the character, to take the kind of liberties that I wanted to take with him. I felt that it was pretty important then that I did my homework well. Mm. So I had known the stories as a boy. I had read them. I was very familiar with them from my childhood. So I wanted to create a more authentic version of... I was running on the idea that Sherlock Holmes really did exist. So I was going to follow it to its logical or illogical conclusion, depending on how you feel about these things. And so it was important that there was no elementary My Dear Watson kind of moment, or that he was wearing a deerstalker hat, which he didn't in the Conan Doyle stories, and that he wasn't smoking a big meerschaum pipe. But yeah, it was important for me to get as much of the details right, so that way I could then also embellish and create my own kind of story about him.
Now, you used the phrase taking liberties. Were you a bit worried when the book came out that fans of Sherlock Holmes wouldn't enjoy it?
Indeed, I was actually. Only after I finished writing it and it was set to come out, I felt a lot better when one of the foremost authorities on Sherlock Holmes, a man named Leslie Klinger, who did the new annotated Sherlock Holmes, wrote a book review of it for the Los Angeles Times Book Review and was a very, very positive review. I think after that, I felt a lot better about how it would be received. With the Holmes, the real serious Holmes scholars, I tend to I think they appreciate the work I put into it and kind of understand what I was trying to do. I've called them the kind of casual, earnest Sherlock Holmes fans. It's been mixed. Some have been very mad at me. I've received some angry mail, kind of as of the nature of, why would you do this? Why? Who? You know? How dare you? And I understand it. My reply to them is always, you know, it's fiction, and you're always free to write your own version of Sherlock Holmes reading this book and not liking it, and you know. But for the most part, I've had a very good response to it.
Now, there's a movie version. Were you excited when you heard Ian McKellen was going to be cast?
Can you imagine? I was delighted. A fantastic day, and I thought I was dreaming. He's the perfect man for it. I think he'll bring the poignancy to it and the intelligence to it that I think will do justice. And it's a really, Bill Condon is directing it, and he had worked with Ian McKellen on Gods and Monsters, so it's a reunion of those two guys. I think it's just going to be a fine film, and very different than the Benedict Cumberbatch Sherlock Holmes. It'll be a little more quiet, I think.
Mm. Now, photography is your background, and you said your writing is a continuation of your photography.
It's true, actually. I think if you look at the writing, when I write, I'm definitely thinking in terms of visual images, and often static visual images. It's just kind of the way my brain is trained. So when a single photograph can tell a story, and it can be one that the viewer can interpret in different ways depending on who they are, I think that sensibility came into the writing as well. I tend to try and write in a way that whoever's reading it, whoever they are, each individual can bring themselves into it in a way that they can make it their own, or at least perceive it in a way that aligns with their own perception of things, if I've done it well. Sometimes I've failed horribly at that attempt, but definitely I try to do it on some level.
Now, have you heard the audio version of it?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. My gosh. See, this is why I don't like reading the book, because Simon Jones, he does such a great job at it, whereas I just sound like a hick. So, yeah, I think he's done a brilliant job with the audiobook.
I'll go back to that in a second, but did you ever consider reading it yourself?
They didn't ask me. They were probably they were probably smart not to. It actually was kind of serendipitous, because Simon Jones is, you know, he was on the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, I think, radio show, and worked with the Pythons, worked with Terry Gilliam as well on a few things. So things kind of connected in a way to Tideland and other things. So he seemed like the right guy for it. But no, no one wanted my, you know, my draw on it.
Now, going back to Simon Jones' reading of it, do you think the imagery comes across in his voice as well?
I do, actually. And I think he actually, his dramatic ability, which is unique, makes it almost a performance. When I first heard it, I realized, it sounds much more poetic than I thought it would sound through the way he reads it. So it's definitely a unique way to experience the book.
"Excellent," Holmes said. "You have summoned these creatures admirably, Roger. I am very pleased by your diligence here." Then, rewarding the boy, he removed the vial from his pocket, presenting it between a crooked finger and a thumb. "This was meant for you," he said, watching as Roger accepted the container and gazed at its contents with mild wonder. "Apis carana japonica, or perhaps we will simply call them Japanese honeybees. How's that? Thank you, sir.
Now, you're obviously American. How hard was it to write as an Englishman?
Very hard. A large portion of the book is in my voice, so the omniscient, I'll call it the omniscient voice. That's more my voice. The pastiche part of the book, which would be the section written by Holmes, was very difficult. And I wrote it with copies of Conan Doyle's books all around me, and not easy. Now, luckily, I had enough friends who are British who I could show it to, and they could laugh at certain things I had done completely wrong. And they did. But I defy anyone, whether you're an American or British or from wherever, to try and write in that way and not perhaps do it 100%. It wasn't easy. I'm glad I'll never have to do it again. It was difficult.
Yes, it's a myth that we share the same language.
Yeah, that's true.
And now, how important for you is it that your books are available to everyone, be it in audio and braille or electronically on Kindle?
It's very important to me because I don't really write for a specific audience. I'm writing for everyone, or hopefully I'm writing for everyone. And I want my books to reach as many people as possible. And so I want them out as audiobooks. I want them out in Kindle. I want them out in as many languages as possible. It sounds selfish, but it's not wholly selfish. I want them available to people everywhere.
Holmes gasped, waking. His eyelids lifted, and he glanced around the library while clearing his throat. Then he inhaled deeply, noting the slant of waning sunlight coming from a west-facing window. The resulting glow and shadow cast across the polished slats of the floor, creeping like clock hands, just enough to touch the hem of the Persian rug underneath his feet, told him it was precisely 5:18 in the afternoon.
Simon Jones there, reading A Slight Trick of the Mind by Mitch Cullen. It's published in the UK by Canongate, and it's available now in print on Kindle and in audio.
Thanks to Robert Kirkwood and to Mitch Cullen. You're listening to Read On. Coming up soon, David Thorpe reveals some ornithological facts from Nightingales in November, and Cara Hunter will share the books of her life. But first... For the past couple of years, one book title has repeatedly come up whenever I've been talking to others who love a good thriller. Kalimpsky Heights.
On the 28th of August, Porter arrived at Narita Airport, picked up his bags, negotiated immigration and customs, and descended to the train. A car was waiting for him outside, as he knew. He had no intention of taking it. The airport express could get him where he wanted, which was Tokyo Central Station. He made it by 5 o'clock, to find the rush hour in progress. This was the second rush hour of the day, the homeward streaming one, and the familiar riot was in progress. He spent some minutes getting his bearings and located the Lucky Strike. It looked no different from the other business efficiencies around the station, but it stood on a corner and had two entrances. This was his attraction, and he remembered it. They wouldn't remember him.
Most recently, Anthony Horowitz, the author commissioned by the Ian Fleming Estate to continue the James Bond series, selected it as one of the books of his life. I'd reached a tipping point. I had to read this book. It's not available on Overdrive, but there is a copy narrated by volunteers in the RNIB Talking Books Library. So, with the prospect of a couple of quiet nights in ahead of me, I dusted off my Daisy machine, plugged in the USB stick, and prepared to be thrilled. And if the publisher's blurb was anything to go by, I was in for a treat. It's the early 1990s, and though the Berlin Wall might have gone, post-Soviet Russia still retains its biological research facilities. John Raven Porter, a Canadian Native American, professor of linguistics and survival expert, receives a summons from a Russian scientist he believed was dead. With the help of MI6 and the CIA, Raven is smuggled into Siberia, after which he's on his own. Somehow he must infiltrate the secret research center where the scientist works.
But it's buried deep beneath the permafrost, inside a remote mountain, and no one is permitted to leave it alive.
How many nights? The Lucky Strike clerk asked him. I'm not sure. Say four. Say four, you pay up front four. Okay, Porter said, and gave him a credit card. The man looked at it and turned it over. You American, Australian, what? He said. He had been shouting in slow Japanese himself. Canadian. Ah, sorry, thought Korean, the clerk apologised. Porter was pleased about that. Give me some telephone tokens, he said. Give me 10, I'll pay now. Are you sure Canadian is all right? The man said. He gave the tokens, and Porter waited while his card was checked out. It was very hot and steamy, and he was sweating under the wig. His pigtail was fixed tight inside.
Klimsky Heights is a classic spy story. Raven has the cold calculation, ruthlessness and sexual appetite of James Bond. But the book's pacing and its attention to the detail of a spy's tradecraft is far closer to the work of John le Carré or Frederick Forsyth. There's also a meticulously researched scientific subplot involving genetic manipulation that Michael Crichton would have been proud of. This subplot, along with other aspects of the book concerning sight loss, made it even more unputdownable and kept me up way past my bedtime, two nights running. Lionel Davidson was one of Britain's top spy novelists during the 1960s and 1970s. His debut novel, The Night of Wenceslasness, was an instant success and won him the first of three Crime Writers Association Gold Dagger Awards. But then he wrote nothing else for 16 years until, in 1994, the publication of Klimsky Heights. It was hailed as a remarkable return to form, but also turned out to be his last hurrah. He was to write nothing else before his death in 2009. Somehow I missed Klimsky Heights the first time round, despite having read or seen the film versions of a couple of Lionel Davidson's earlier novels, which makes me glad for this renaissance of interest in his book. And very grateful to the team of volunteers from the RNIB Transcription Service Northwest, who took the trouble to record it back in 2009. Klimsky Heights, spelt K-O-L-Y-M-S-K-Y, by Lionel Davidson, is TB-403611, and other books by Lionel Davidson are also available in a range of accessible forms from the RNIB Library. Just go to the RNIB Library website, rniblibrary.com, or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999. Do you have a book that you think would send me on a reading adventure? Or maybe you found a hidden gem in the library that you'd like to share? Why not drop us a line via the usual address, readonair@rnib.org.uk. We'd love to hear from you.
Talking Books.
In the Talking Books Library.
They've found her, my lord! Ned rose quickly. Ermen or Lannisters? It was Jory, Daenerys Targaryen, wed Khal Drogo with fear and barbaric splendour in a field beyond the walls of Pentos. The North went on forever. Tyrion Lannister knew the maps as well as anyone, but a fortnight on the wild track that passed for the King's Road up here had brought home the lesson that the map was one thing and the land quite another.
Game of Thrones by George R.R. Martin. Book 1 in A Song of Ice and Fire.
The courtyard rang to the sound of swords. Under black wool, boiled leather, and mail, sweat trickled icily down John's chest as he pressed the attack.
Narrated by Tom Carter, it lasts 35 hours and 2 minutes. Talking book number 19231.
Tell Jory to bring her here at once. I am sorry, my lord, Poole told him. The guards on the gate were Lannister men, and they informed the Queen when Jory brought her in. She's been taken directly before the King.
Also available are A Clash of Kings, A Storm of Swords, A Feast for Crows, and A Dance with Dragons. And many of them you can buy as a Daisy CD. For more information, head to www.rnib.org.uk.
Talking Books on RNIB Connect Radio.
Here's a familiar voice with some new facts for us.
Nightingale. When it comes to appearances, the nightingale can hardly be called devastatingly handsome. But then, who needs to look like George Clooney when you have a voice with more range than Pavarotti?
On my way to the kitchen to get yet another cup of coffee, I came across my old mucker, David Thorpe, fresh from the studio, having recorded some non-fiction for a change. And he was waxing lyrical about some of the habits of magpies. So I decided to drag him into the studio and find out a little bit more. David, tell me what you've been reading.
I've been reading, a marvellous book called Nightingales in November, which is a year in the lives of 12 British birds by a guy called Mike Dilger, who is the natural history guy that you may have seen on BBC One's The One Show. And he is a bird expert and has also enlisted the help of various other bird experts and taken a book that looks at the lives of 12 British birds throughout the year. And it sounds like it could be quite a dry, fact-based sort of not terribly exciting read, but the way he's structured this book is fantastic. It's turned it into a sort of story that beautifully flows from one thing to the next.
I can see you twitching with excitement. So you were telling me that magpies actually have funerals.
They do. Now, I've got to just qualify this because I got sidetracked when we were talking. Magpies aren't actually one of the birds featured in this book. I've also been recently doing another book called A Tiding of Magpies, which was there's a subgenre you may be aware of called Bird and Murder Mysteries. This was one of those. And that was where all the facts about magpies came from. But yes, magpies do have funerals. They have a little gathering around the dead magpie. They lay some vegetation beside it, pause for a moment, and then fly off.
Ooh, and they're not thieves either, apparently.
They're not thieves. And also, the other thing I forgot to tell you, which I remembered last night, is that they are the only non-mammal that can recognise themselves in a mirror.
Crikey.
Yeah.
Well, it's more than I can nowadays. What else did you learn from Nightingales in November?
Loads. One of the species that he does pick up on that he follows through the year is the cuckoo. And I have to say, I've been lucky enough to do another book about cuckoos, solely about cuckoos. And I think cuckoos are amazing. I know people we impose our sort of moral judgments on cuckoos because what they do is pretty awful. And I also learned from this book that after the mother cuckoo has, usurped put her egg into the host adoptive family's nest, she then apparently flies away and sits on a branch and laughs, which I thought was quite nasty. But so that's that. But one thing I found out about cuckoos that I think is amazing is that the cuckoo parents, as we know, abandon their young. They go back to Africa, which is where they are for most of the year, in August. So they're gone before the young are able to fly properly. So the young stay on, the newborns stay on for another month or so, feeding up on, I think it's caterpillars they eat. And then a month later, they fly to Africa. But unlike most migrating birds, which will have the parents fly with the children so they get an idea of where they're going, they just know where to go, which blew my mind when I found that out. Hardwired into them.
I take it that a nightingale has never sung in Berkeley Square. It's something else like a wren or something like that, is it? Or
he doesn't touch on that, sadly, in the book. Is there any reason why it couldn't have? I don't know. They're lovely. Nightingales are lovely, though. They practice their song. They have a sort of practice, because they're doing it to attract the attention of their mate. But they have sort of they spend some time in rehearsal. I quite like that when they're away, and then get it all together for the breeding season, the mating season. Yeah.
So has this inspired you to sort of invest in a pair of binoculars? Are you going to be heading out to the fens and putting what you've read into practice?
I've never done it. I've never really bird watched at all. It does kind of appeal to me. I'm lucky enough to live in Walthamstow in East London, which has the beautiful Walthamstow marshes and now the wetlands, which I still haven't visited. And I think, yeah, I might take along a pair of binoculars if I'm next got a bit of time to go and explore there.
Fantastic. Well, maybe we should meet up and go and feed the ducks before we head to the pub. David Thorpe, I suppose I better let you get back to work. Thank you so much for giving up your coffee break. And, right, let's go and open that packet of custard creams.
It's a pleasure.
The Nightingale's rich, melodic and powerful song has been celebrated for generations. But scour the literature and surprisingly little is known about the bird's life history. Famous for skulking, most birdwatchers can count on the fingers of one hand the number of decent views of a nightingale they have ever had. Arriving in its British breeding grounds in spring, after the most incredible journey, which began in West Africa and included both flights around the Sahara and over the Mediterranean, the male must first carve out a territory and find a mate. The main tool the male will use to achieve these twin aims is its beautiful and technical song, which, upon arrival, will initially be belted out day and night across all southern and eastern counties lucky enough to host this marvellous migrant for a few short spring and summer weeks.
Nightingales in November, a year in the life of 12 British birds, narrated by David Thorpe and written by Miles Dilger, is TB24515. It's also available in Braille and giant print from the RNIB Library. For more information, visit the website rniblibrary.com or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999. That's 0303 123 9999. And now it's back to Cara Hunter for the books of her life. So Cara, was there a book that you read as a child or a young woman that made you fall in love with reading or wish to become a writer?
Fall in love with reading, definitely, and this one probably won't surprise anybody, but I read The Lord of the Rings when I was about 12, and I've been in love with it ever since. It just completely blew my mind in the best possible way. It created a whole new world. It just amazing. And some of my own values, if you like, were formed by that book. You know, respect for nature, for example. Reading at a formative age like that really made a huge difference to me. And it changed my life in the sense that I became even more passionate about reading and decided I wanted to study English literature. And I actually wanted to study it where Tolkien himself was teaching, which he was, I think, still alive at the time. And so I suddenly had this wonderful, huge ambition to go to Oxford, which I worked very, very hard for and did actually achieve and did read English at Oxford. And so, yes, in a way, that book did change my life.
At no time had hobbits of any kind been warlike, and they had never fought among themselves. In olden days, they had, of course, been often obliged to fight to maintain themselves in a hard world, but in Bilbo's time, that was very ancient history. The last battle before this story opens, and indeed the only one that had ever been fought within the borders of the Shire, was beyond living memory. The Battle of Greenfields, SR 1147, in which Bandobras Took routed an invasion of orcs. Even the weathers had grown milder, and the wolves that had once come ravening out of the north in the bitter white winters were now only a grandfather's tale. So though there was still some store of weapons in the Shire, these were mostly used as trophies, hanging above hearths or on walls, or gathered into the museum at Michel Delving. The Madam House, it was called. For anything that hobbits had no immediate use for, but were unwilling to throw away, they called a Madam.
All the books in J.R.R. Tolkien's The Lord of the Rings series are available in a full range of accessible formats from the RNIB Library, including this talking book version of The Fellowship of the Ring, TB14593, narrated by David Banks. And is there a book that on a rainy day you'd like to curl up with and reread?
There are several, actually, but and I was thinking, actually, my way here, which one should I plump for? But I think I'm going to go for one of the early reads in terms of crime that made me think, wouldn't it be fantastic to be able to write a good crime book? And that's Nikki French's first book, which is The Memory Game, which goes back quite a while now, but absolutely wonderful. I've got so many books that I sort of read once and then I give to friends, but that one I've still got. And I think that's a really nice one if you want to explore her books for the first time. It's certainly the one that got me hooked on her.
I close my eyes. It's all there, inside my skull. Mist following the contours of the lawn. A shock of cold stinging in my nostrils. I have to make a conscious effort if I want to remember what else happened on the day we found the body. Her body. The reek of wet, brown leaves. As I made my way down the short, slimy grass slope away from the house, I saw that the workmen were standing there ready. They were clutching mugs of tea and smoking, and their warm, wet breath produced a cloud of vapour that rose up from their faces. They looked like an old bonfire that was being rained on. It was only October, but this was early in the morning, and as yet there was just the promise of sun somewhere behind the clouds, over the copse on the far hill. I was wearing my overalls tucked a little too neatly into my Wellingtons. The men, of course, were obstinately in the traditional rural proletarian costume of jeans, synthetic sweaters and dirty leather boots. They were stamping to keep warm and laughing at something I couldn't hear. When they caught sight of me, they fell silent. We'd all known each other forever, and now they were unsure how to react to me as their boss. It didn't bother me, though. I was used to men on building sites. Even the miniature, domestic variety of building site like this one, my father-in-law's soggy patch of Shropshire, the Stead, as it was absurdly called, a self-mocking joke about rural squireship that had become serious over the years.
The Memory Game, written by Nikki French and narrated by Charlotte Strevens, is TB17808. And finally, is there a book that you've read recently that you'd like to share with the RNIB Connect radio listeners?
Yes, now this is true crime. This is going back to what we touched on earlier, how much of a true crime fanatic I am. I watch loads of it on TV, and my husband teases me about that, or at least he used to. He doesn't anymore because he just nods and says, you're doing more research. It's very funny, but he's right. But the book, which I hope would be available in your library, is I'll Be Gone in the Dark by Michelle McNamara, which is about the Golden State killings, which is a very famous case in America of a crime spree that started way back in the 80s, I think, started as a rapist, gradually became turned into a murderer as well. And it was completely foxing absolutely everybody, the investigative police, and several states just simply couldn't work out who this person was. And Michelle McNamara was a freelance journalist and started getting involved in trying to work out who this person was. And the book is fascinating because it details all of the work she did over a very long period of time and how she connects with other people who were like sort of amateur sleuths. And eventually the sort of work that they were doing has actually resulted in them being able to identify a potential suspect, which sadly has happened after Michelle's own death. She actually died before that happened. But it's a fascinating book, quite recent. I think it was out last year or early this year. But if anyone who's interested in true crime investigations, it's absolutely fascinating, and she writes really well as well.
Drew prided himself on not being squeamish. At the police academy, they were being trained to handle stress and never blanch. Emotional steeliness was a graduation requirement. But until the evening of Friday, February 6th, 1981, when his fiancée's sister appeared tableside at the Rathskeller pub in Huntington Beach and said breathlessly, "Drew, call your mom." He didn't think he'd be required to use those skills, the ability to keep his mouth shut and eyes forward when everyone else went bug-eyed and screamed, so soon or so close to home. David and Manuela lived at 35 Columbus, a single-story tract home in Northwood, a new development in Irvine. The neighborhood was one of the tendrils of suburbia creeping into what was left of the old Irvine Ranch. Orange groves still dominated the outskirts, bordering the encroaching concrete and blacktop with immaculate rows of trees, a packing house, and a camp for pickers. The future of the changing landscape could be gauged in sound. The blast from trucks pouring cement was drowning out the dwindling tractors. An air of genteelness masked Northwood's conveyor belt transformation. Stands of towering eucalyptus, planted by farmers in the 1940s as protection against the punishing Santa Ana winds, weren't torn down but repurposed. Developers used the trees to bisect main thoroughfares and shroud neighborhoods. David and Manuela's subdivision, Shady Hollow, was a tract of 137 houses with four available floor plans. They chose plan 6014, The Willow, three bedrooms, 1,523 square feet. In late 1979, when the house was finished, they moved in.
I'll Be Gone in the Dark, written by Michelle McNamara, is available commercially in print, ebook, and as an audio download, which is narrated by Gabra Zachman. Cara Hunter, thank you so much for sharing your obvious passion for reading with the Read On listeners, and we'll look forward to having you back in the studio when the next Adam Fawley book hits the shelves.
Thank you so much.
Alas, that's all we've got time for this week. My thanks to all my guests and to everyone who's been in touch. Read On will be back at the same time next week, but if you can't wait that long, why not head to our Audio Boom page? All our past shows are there, complete with book news, reviews, and exclusive author interviews. You'll find a link on the front page of our website, rnibconnectradio.org.uk, or you can find producer Robert on Twitter at talking_books. Farewell until next week, and remember to read on.